Something about POTUS struck Gabrielle as being a perfect Sexton password. Simple, positive, self-referential. She quickly typed in the letters. POTUS. Holding her breath, she hit return. The computer beeped. Invalid password, access denied. Slumping, Gabrielle gave up. She headed back toward the bathroom door to exit the way she had come. She was halfway across the room when her cell phone rang. She was already on edge, and the sound startled her. Stopping short, she pulled out her phone and glanced up to check the time on Sexton's prized Jourdain grandfather clock. Almost 4 a.m. At this hour, Gabrielle knew the caller could only be Sexton. He was obviously wondering where the hell she was. Do I pick up or let it ring? If she answered, Gabrielle would have to lie. But if she didn't, Sexton would get suspicious. She took the call. Hello? Gabrielle! Sexton sounded impatient. What's keeping you? The FDR Memorial, Gabrielle said. The taxi got hemmed in, and now we're...
You don't sound like you're in a taxi.
No, she said, her blood pumping now. I'm not. I decided to stop by my office and pick up some NASA documents that might be relevant to pods. I'm having some trouble finding them.
Well, hurry up. I want to schedule a press conference for the morning, and we need to talk specifics.
I'm coming soon, she said.
There was a pause on the line.
You're in your office?
He sounded suddenly confused.
Yeah, another 10 minutes and I'll be on my way over.
Another pause.
Okay. I'll see you soon.
Gabrielle hung up, too preoccupied to notice the loud and distinctive triple tick of Sexton's prized Jourdain grandfather clock only a few feet away.
Chapter 113. Michael Tallon didn't realize Rachel was hurt until he saw the blood on her arm as he pulled her to cover behind the Triton. He sensed from the catatonic look on her face that she was not aware of any pain. Steadying her, Tallon wheeled to find Corky. The astrophysicist scrambled across the deck to join them, his eyes blank with terror. We've got to find cover, Tallon thought, the horror of what had just happened not yet fully registering. Instinctively, his eyes raced up the tiers of decks above them. The stairs leading up to the bridge were all in the open, and the bridge itself was a glass box, a transparent bullseye from the air. Going up was suicide, which left only one other direction to go. For a fleeting instant, Tallon turned a hopeful gaze to the Triton submersible, wondering perhaps if he could get everyone underwater, away from the bullets. Absurd. The Triton had room for one person. And the deployment winch took a good 10 minutes to lower the sub through the trap door in the deck to the ocean 30 feet below. Besides, without properly charged batteries and compressors, the Triton would be dead in the water.
"Here they come!" Corky shouted, his voice shrill with fear, as he pointed into the sky. Tallon didn't even look up. He pointed to a nearby bulkhead, where an aluminum ramp descended below decks. Corky apparently needed no encouragement. Keeping his head low, Corky scurried toward the opening and disappeared down the incline. Tallon put a firm arm around Rachel's waist and followed. The two of them disappeared below decks just as the helicopter returned, spraying bullets overhead. Tallon helped Rachel down the grated ramp to the suspended platform at the bottom. As they arrived, Tallon could feel Rachel's body go suddenly rigid. He wheeled, fearing maybe she'd been hit by a ricocheting bullet. When he saw her face, he knew it was something else. Tallon followed her petrified gaze downward and immediately understood. Rachel stood motionless, her legs refusing to move. She was staring down at the bizarre world beneath her. Because of its swath design, the Goya had no hull, but rather struts like a giant catamaran. They had just descended through the deck onto a grated catwalk that hung above an open chasm, 30 feet straight down to the raging sea. The noise was deafening here, reverberating off the underside of the deck. Adding to Rachel's terror was the fact that the ship's underwater spotlights were still illuminated, casting a greenish effulgence deep into the ocean directly beneath her.
She found herself gazing down at 6 or 7 ghostly silhouettes in the water. Enormous hammerhead sharks. Their long shadows swimming in place against the current, rubbery bodies flexing back and forth. Tallinn's voice was in her ear.
Rachel, you're okay. Eyes straight ahead. I'm right behind you.
His hands were reaching around from behind, gently trying to coax her clenched fists off the banister. It was then that Rachel saw the crimson droplet of blood roll off her arm and fall through the grating. Her eyes followed the drip as it plummeted toward the sea. Although she never saw it hit the water, she knew the instant it happened because all at once the hammerheads spun in unison, thrusting with their powerful tails, crashing together in a roiling frenzy of teeth and fins. Enhanced telencephalon olfactory lobes. They smell blood a mile away.
Eyes straight ahead, Tallinn repeated, his voice strong and reassuring. I'm right behind you.
Rachel felt his hands on her hips now, urging her forward. Blocking out the void beneath her, Rachel started down the catwalk. Somewhere above, she could hear the rotors of the chopper again. Corky was already well out in front of them, reeling across the catwalk in a kind of drunken panic. Tallinn called out to him.
All the way to the far strut, Corky. Down the stairs.
Rachel could now see where they were headed. Up ahead, a series of switchback ramps descended. At water level, a narrow, shelf-like deck extended the length of the Goya. Jutting off this deck were several small, suspended docks, creating a kind of miniature marina stationed beneath the ship. A large sign read, Dive Area. Swimmers may surface without warning. Boats proceed with caution. Rachel could only assume Michael didn't intend for them to do any swimming. Her trepidation intensified when Tallinn stopped at a bank of wire mesh storage lockers flanking the catwalk. He pulled open the doors to reveal hanging wetsuits, snorkels, flippers, life jackets, and spear guns. Before she could protest, he reached in and grabbed a flare gun.
Let's go. They were moving again.
Up ahead, Corky had reached the switchback ramps and was already halfway down.
I see it!
He shouted, his voice sounding almost joyous over the raging water.
See what?
Rachel wondered, as Corky ran along the narrow walkway. All she could see was a shark-infested ocean lapping dangerously close. Tallinn urged her forward, and suddenly Rachel could see what Corky was so excited about. At the far end of the decking below, a small powerboat was moored. Corky ran toward it. Rachel stared.
Outrun a helicopter in a motorboat?
It has a radio, Tallinn said. And if we can get far enough away from the helicopter's jamming... Rachel didn't hear another word he said. She had just spied something that made her blood run cold.
Too late,
she croaked, extending a trembling finger.
We're finished.
When Tallinn turned, he knew in an instant it was over. At the far end of the ship, like a dragon peering into the opening of a cave, the black helicopter had dropped down low and was facing them. For an instant, Tallinn thought it was going to fly directly at them through the center of the boat. But the helicopter began to turn at an angle, taking aim. Tallinn followed the direction of the gun barrels.
No!
Crouched beside the powerboat, untying the moorings, Corky glanced up just as the machine guns beneath the chopper erupted in a blaze of thunder. Corky lurched as if hit. Wildly, he scrambled over the gunwale and dove into the boat, sprawled himself on the floor for cover. The guns stopped. Tallinn could see Corky crawling deeper into the powerboat. The lower part of his right leg was covered with blood. Crouched below the dash, Corky reached up and fumbled across the controls until his fingers found the key. The boat's 250-horsepower Mercury engine roared to life. An instant later, a red laser beam appeared, emanating from the nose of the hovering chopper, targeting the powerboat with a missile. Tallinn reacted on instinct, aiming the only weapon he had. The flare gun in his hand hissed when he pulled the trigger, and a blinding streak tore away on a horizontal trajectory beneath the ship, heading directly toward the chopper. Even so, Tallinn sensed he had acted too late. As the streaking flare bore down on the helicopter's windshield, the rocket launcher beneath the chopper emitted its own flash of light. At the same exact instant that the missile launched, the aircraft veered sharply and pulled up out of sight to avoid the incoming flare.
"Look out!" Tolan yelled, yanking Rachel down onto the catwalk.
The missile sailed off course, just missing Corky, coming the length of the Goya and slamming into the base of the strut 30 feet beneath Rachel and Tolland. The sound was apocalyptic. Water and flames erupted beneath them. Bits of twisted metal flew in the air and scattered the catwalk beneath them. Metal on metal ground together as the ship shifted, finding a new balance, slightly askew. As the smoke cleared, Tolland could see that one of the Goya's 4 main struts had been severely damaged. Powerful currents tore past the pontoon, threatening to break it off. The spiral stairway descending to the lower deck looked to be hanging by a thread.
"Come on," Tolland yelled, urging Rachel toward it. "We've got to get down."
But they were too late. With a surrendering crack, the stairs peeled away from the damaged strut and crashed into the sea. Over the ship, Delta One grappled with the controls of the Kiowa helicopter and got it back under control. Momentarily blinded by the incoming flare, he had reflexively pulled up, causing the Hellfire missile to miss its mark. Cursing, he hovered now over the bow of the ship and prepared to drop back down and finish the job. Eliminate all passengers. The controller's demands had been clear.
"Shit! Look!"
Delta Two yelled from the rear seat, pointing out the window.
"Speedboat!"
Delta One spun and saw a bullet-riddled Crestliner speedboat skimming away from the Goya into the darkness. He had a decision to make. Chapter 114 Corky's bloody hands gripped the wheel of the Crestliner Phantom 2100 as it pounded out across the sea. He rammed the throttle all the way forward, trying to eke out maximum speed. It wasn't until this moment that he felt the searing pain. He looked down and saw his right leg spurting blood. He felt instantly dizzy. Propping himself against the wheel, he turned and looked back at the Goya, willing the helicopter to follow him. With Tolland and Rachel trapped up on the catwalk, Corky hadn't been able to reach them. He'd been forced to make a snap decision. Divide and conquer. Corky knew if he could lure the chopper far enough away from the Goya, maybe Tolland and Rachel could radio for help. Unfortunately, as he looked over his shoulder at the illuminated ship, Corky could see the chopper still hovering there, as if undecided.
"Come on, you bastards! Follow me!"
But the helicopter didn't follow. Instead, it banked over the stern of the Goya, aligned itself, and dropped down, landing on the deck.
"No!"
Corky watched in horror, now realizing he'd left Tolland and Rachel behind to be killed. Knowing it was now up to him to radio for help, Corky groped the dashboard and found the radio. He flicked the power switch. Nothing happened. No lights, no static. He turned the volume knob all the way up. Nothing.
"Come on!"
Letting go of the wheel, he knelt down for a look. His leg screamed in pain as he bent down. His eyes focused on the radio. He couldn't believe what he was looking at. The dashboard had been strafed by bullets, and the radio dial was shattered. Loose wires hung out the front. He stared, incredulous.
"Of all the goddamn luck!"
Weak-kneed, Corky stood back up, wondering how things could get any worse. As he looked back at the Goya, he got his answer. 2 armed soldiers jumped out of the chopper onto the deck. Then the chopper lifted off again, turning in Corky's direction and coming after him at full speed. Corky slumped.
Divide and conquer.
Apparently he was not the only one with that bright idea tonight. As Delta Three made his way across the deck and approached the grated ramp leading below decks, he heard a woman shouting somewhere beneath him. He turned and motioned to Delta Two that he was going below decks to check it out. His partner nodded, remaining behind to cover the upper level. The two men could stay in contact via cryptalk. The Kiowa's jamming system ingeniously left an obscure bandwidth open for their own communications. Clutching his snub-nosed machine gun, Delta III moved quietly toward the ramp that led below decks. With the vigilance of a trained killer, he began inching downward, gun leveled. The incline provided limited visibility, and Delta III crouched low for a better view. He could hear the shouting more clearly now. He kept descending. Halfway down the stairs, he could now make out the twisted maze of walkways attached to the underside of the Goya. The shouting grew louder. Then he saw her. Midway across the traversing catwalk, Rachel Sexton was peering over a railing and calling desperately toward the water for Michael Tolland. Did Tolland fall in? Perhaps in the blast? If so, Delta III's job would be even easier than expected. He only needed to descend another couple of feet to have an open shot. Shooting fish in a barrel. His only vague concern was Rachel standing near an open equipment locker, which meant she might have a weapon, a spear gun, or a shark rifle, although neither would be any match for his machine gun. Confident he was in control of the situation, Delta III leveled his weapon and took another step down. Rachel Sexton was almost in perfect view now. He raised the gun. One more step. The flurry of movement came from beneath him, under the stairs. Delta III was more confused than frightened as he looked down and saw Michael Tolland thrusting an aluminum pole out toward his feet. Although Delta III had been tricked, he almost laughed at this lame attempt to trip him up. Then he felt the tip of the stick connect with his heel. A blast of white-hot pain shot through his body as his right foot exploded out from under him from a blistering impact. His balance gone, Delta III flailed, tumbling down the stairs. His machine gun clattered down the ramp and went overboard as he collapsed on the catwalk. In anguish, he curled up to grip his right foot. But it was no longer there. Tolland was standing over his attacker immediately, with his hands still clenching the smoking bang stick, a 5-foot powerhead shark control device. The aluminum pole had been tipped with a pressure-sensitive 12-gauge shotgun shell and was intended for self-defense in the event of a shark attack. Tolland had reloaded the bang stick with another shell and now held the jagged, smoldering point to his attacker's Adam's apple. The man lay on his back as if paralyzed, staring up at Tolland with an expression of astonished rage and agony. Rachel came running up the catwalk. The plan was for her to take the man's machine gun, but unfortunately the weapon had gone over the edge of the catwalk into the ocean. The communications device on the man's belt crackled. The voice coming out was robotic. Delta III, come in. I heard a shot. The man made no move to answer. The device crackled again. Delta III, confirm. Do you need backup? Almost immediately, a new voice crackled over the line. It was also robotic, but distinguishable by the sound of a helicopter noise in the background. This is Delta I, the pilot said. I'm in pursuit of the departing vessel. Delta III, confirm. Are you down? Do you need backup? Tolland pressed the bang stick into the man's throat. Tell the helicopter to back off that speedboat. If they kill my friend, you die. The soldier winced in pain as he lifted his communication device to his lips. He looked directly at Tolland as he pressed the button and spoke. Delta III here. I'm fine. Destroy the departing vessel. Chapter 115. Gabrielle Ash returned to Sexton's private bathroom, preparing to climb back out of his office. Sexton's phone call had left her feeling anxious. He had definitely hesitated when she told him she was in her office, as if he knew somehow she was lying. Either way, she'd failed to get into Sexton's computer and now was unsure of her next move. Sexton is waiting. As she climbed up onto the sink, getting ready to pull herself up, she heard something clatter to the tile floor. She looked down, irritated to see that she'd knocked off a pair of Sexton's cufflinks that had apparently been sitting on the edge of the sink. Leave things exactly as you found them.
Climbing back down, Gabrielle picked up the cufflinks and put them back on the sink. As she began to climb back up, she paused, glancing again at the cufflinks. On any other night, Gabrielle would have ignored them, but tonight, their monogram caught her attention. Like most of Sexton's monogrammed items, they had two intertwining letters, SS. Gabrielle flashed on Sexton's initial computer password, SSS. She pictured his calendar, POTUS, and the White House screensaver with its optimistic ticker tape crawling around the screen ad infinitum. President of the United States, Sedgwick Sexton. President of the United States, Sedgwick Sexton. President of the... Gabrielle stood a moment and wondered. Could he be that confident? Knowing it would take only an instant to find out, she hurried back into Sexton's office, went to his computer, and typed in a seven-letter password. POTUSSS. The screensaver evaporated instantly. She stared, incredulous. Never underestimate the ego of a politician. Chapter 116. Corky Marlinson was no longer at the helm of the Crestliner Phantom as it raced into the night. He knew the boat would travel in a straight line with or without him at the wheel, the path of least resistance. Corky was in the back of the bouncing boat, trying to assess the damage to his leg. A bullet had entered the front part of his calf, just missing his shin bone. There was no exit wound on the back of his calf, so he knew the bullet must still be lodged in his leg. Foraging around for something to stem the bleeding, he found nothing. Some fins, a snorkel, and a couple of life jackets. No first aid kit. Frantically, Corky opened a small utility chest and found some tools, rags, duct tape, oil, and other maintenance items. He looked at his bloody leg and wondered how far he had to go to be out of shark territory. A hell of a lot farther than this. Delta One kept the Kiowa chopper low over the ocean as he scanned the darkness for the departing Crestliner. Assuming the fleeing boat would head for shore and attempt to put as much distance as possible between itself and the Goya, Delta One had followed the Crestliner's original trajectory away from the Goya. I should have overtaken him by now. Normally, tracking the fleeing boat would be a simple matter of using radar, but with the Kiowa's jamming systems transmitting an umbrella of thermal noise for several miles, his radar was worthless. Turning off the jamming system was not an option until he got word that everyone on board the Goya was dead. No emergency phone calls would be leaving the Goya this evening. This meteorite secret dies right here, right now. Fortunately, Delta One had other means of tracking. Even against this bizarre backdrop of heated ocean, pinpointing a powerboat's thermal imprint was simple. He turned on his thermal scanner. The ocean around him registered a warm 95 degrees. Fortunately, the emissions of a racing 250-horsepower outboard engine were hundreds of degrees hotter. Corky Marlinson's leg and foot felt numb. Not knowing what else to do, he had wiped down his injured calf with a rag and wrapped the wound in layer after layer of duct tape. By the time the tape was gone, his entire calf, from ankle to knee, was enveloped in a tight silver sheath. The bleeding had stopped, although his clothing and hands were still covered with blood. Sitting on the floor of the runaway Crestliner, Corky felt confused about why the chopper hadn't found him yet. He looked out now, scanning the horizon behind him, expecting to see the distant Goya and incoming helicopter. Oddly, he saw neither. The lights of the Goya had disappeared. Certainly he hadn't come that far, had he? Corky suddenly felt hopeful he might escape. Maybe they had lost him in the dark. Maybe he could get to shore. It was then he noticed that the wake behind his boat was not straight. It seemed to curve gradually away from the back of his boat, as if he were traveling in an arc rather than a straight line. Confused by this, he turned his head to follow the wake's arc, extrapolating a giant curve across the ocean.
An instant later, he saw it. The Goya was directly off his port side, less than a half mile away. In horror, Corky realized his mistake too late. With no one at the wheel, the Crestliner's bow had continuously realigned itself with the direction of the powerful current, the megaplume's circular water flow.
"I'm driving in a big frigging circle!"
He had doubled back on himself. Knowing he was still inside the shark-filled megaplume, Corky recalled Tallinn's grim words. "Enhanced telencephalon olfactory lobes. Hammerheads can smell a droplet of blood a mile away." Corky looked at his bloody, duct-taped leg and hands. The chopper would be on him soon. Ripping off his bloody clothing, Corky scrambled naked toward the stern. Knowing no sharks could possibly keep pace with the boat, he rinsed himself as best he could in the powerful blast of the wake. A single droplet of blood. As Corky stood up, fully exposed to the night, he knew there was only one thing left to do. He had learned once that animals marked their territory with urine because uric acid was the most potent-smelling fluid the human body made. More potent than blood, he hoped. Wishing he'd had a few more beers tonight, Corky heaved his injured leg up onto the gunwale and tried to urinate on the duct tape.
"Come on!"
He waited.
"Nothing like the pressure of having to piss all over yourself with a helicopter chasing you."
Finally it came. Corky urinated all over the duct tape, soaking it fully. He used what little was left in his bladder to soak a rag, which he then swathed across his entire body.
Very pleasant.
In the dark sky overhead, a red laser beam appeared, slanting toward him like the shimmering blade of an enormous guillotine. The chopper appeared from an oblique angle. The pilot apparently confused that Corky had looped back toward the Goya. Quickly donning a high-float life vest, Corky moved to the rear of the speeding craft. On the boat's blood-stained floor, only 5 feet from where Corky was standing, a glowing red dot appeared. It was time. On board the Goya, Michael Tallinn didn't see his Crestliner Phantom 2100 erupt in flames and tumble through the air in a cartwheel of fire and smoke. But he heard the explosion. Chapter 117. The West Wing was unusually quiet at this hour, but the President's unexpected emergence in his bathrobe and slippers had rustled the aides and on-site staff out of their daytimer beds and on-site sleeping quarters.
"I can't find her, Mr. President,"
a young aide said, hurrying after him into the Oval Office. He had looked everywhere.
"Miss Tench is not answering her pager or cell phone."
The President looked exasperated.
"Have you looked in the..."
"She left the building, sir,"
another aide announced, hurrying in.
"She signed out about an hour ago. We think she may have gone to the NRO. One of the operators says she and Pickering were talking tonight."
"William Pickering?"
The President sounded baffled. Tench and Pickering were anything but social.
"Have you called him?"
"He's not answering either, sir. NRO switchboard can't reach him. They say Pickering's cell phone isn't even ringing. It's like he's dropped off the face of the earth."
Herney stared at his aides for a moment and then walked to the bar and poured himself a bourbon. As he raised the glass to his lips, a Secret Service man hurried in.
"Mr. President, I wasn't going to wake you, but you should be aware that there was a car bombing at the FDR Memorial tonight."
"What?" Herney almost dropped his drink.
"When?"
"An hour ago." His face was grim. "And the FBI just identified the victim." Chapter 118. Delta III's foot screamed in pain. He felt himself floating through a muddled consciousness.
"Is this death?"
He tried to move but felt paralyzed, barely able to breathe. He saw only blurred shapes. His mind reeled back, recalling the explosion of the Crestliner out at sea. seeing the rage in Michael Tollin's eyes as the oceanographer stood over him, holding the explosive pole to his throat. Certainly Tollin killed me. And yet the searing pain in Delta III's right foot told him he was very much alive. Slowly it came back. On hearing the explosion of the Crestliner, Tollin had let out a cry of anguished rage for his lost friend. Then, turning his ravaged eyes to Delta III, Tollin had arched as if preparing to ram the rod through Delta III's throat. But as he did, he seemed to hesitate, as if his own morality were holding him back. With brutal frustration and fury, Tollin yanked the rod away and drove his boot down on Delta III's tattered foot. The last thing Delta III remembered was vomiting in agony, as his whole world drifted into a black delirium. Now he was coming to, with no idea how long he had been unconscious. He could feel his arms tied behind his back in a knot so tight it could only have been tied by a sailor. His legs were also bound, bent behind him and tied to his wrists, leaving him in an immobilized backward arch. He tried to call out, but no sound came. His mouth was stuffed with something. Delta III couldn't imagine what was going on. It was then he felt the cool breeze and saw the bright lights. He realized he was up on the Goya's main deck. He twisted to look for help and was met by a frightful sight, his own reflection, bulbous and misshapen in the reflective plexiglass bubble of the Goya's deep water submersible. The sub hung right in front of him, and Delta III realized he was lying on a giant trap door in the deck. This was not nearly as unsettling as the most obvious question. If I'm on deck, then where is Delta II? Delta II had grown uneasy. Despite his partner's cryptalk transmission claiming he was fine, the single gunshot had not been that of a machine gun. Obviously, Tollin or Rachel Sexton had fired a weapon. Delta II moved over to peer down the ramp where his partner had descended, and he saw blood. Weapon raised, he had descended below decks, where he followed the trail of blood along a catwalk to the bow of the ship. Here, the trail of blood had led him back up another ramp to the main deck. It was deserted. With growing wariness, Delta II had followed the long crimson smear along the sideboard deck back toward the rear of the ship, where it passed the opening to the original ramp he had descended. What the hell is going on? The smear seemed to travel in a giant circle. Moving cautiously, his gun trained ahead of him, Delta II passed the entrance to the laboratory section of the ship. The smear continued toward the stern deck. Carefully, he swung wide, rounding the corner. His eyes traced the trail. Then he saw it. Jesus Christ! Delta III was lying there, bound and gagged, dumped unceremoniously directly in front of the Goya's small submersible. Even from a distance, Delta II could see that his partner was missing a good portion of his right foot. Wary of a trap, Delta II raised his gun and moved forward. Delta III was writhing now, trying to speak. Ironically, the way the man had been bound, with his knees sharply bent behind him, was probably saving his life. The bleeding in his foot appeared to have slowed. As Delta II approached the submersible, he appreciated the rare luxury of being able to watch his own back. The entire deck of the ship was reflected in the sub's rounded cockpit dome. Delta II arrived at his struggling partner. He saw the warning in his eyes too late. The flash of silver came out of nowhere. One of the Triton's manipulator claws suddenly leaped forward and clamped down on Delta II's left thigh with crushing force. He tried to pull away, but the claw bore down. He screamed in pain, feeling a bone break. His eyes shot to the sub's cockpit. Peering through the reflection of the deck, Delta II could now see him, ensconced in the shadows of the Triton's interior. Michael Tollin was inside the sub, at the controls. "Bad idea," Delta II seethed, blocking out his pain and shouldering his machine gun. He aimed up and to the left at Tollin's chest, only 3 feet away on the other side of the sub's plexiglass dome. He pulled the trigger, and the gun roared. Wild with rage at having been tricked, Delta II held the trigger back until the last of his shells clattered to the deck and his gun clicked empty. Breathless, he dropped the weapon and glared at the shredded dome in front of him.
Dead!
The soldier hissed, straining to pull his leg from the clamp. As he twisted, the metal clamp severed his skin, opening a large gash.
Fuck!
He reached now for the Kryptalk on his belt. But as he raised it to his lips, a second robotic arm snapped open in front of him and lunged forward, clamping around his right arm. The Kryptalk fell to the deck. It was then that Delta II saw the ghost in the window before him, a pale visage leaning sideways and peering out through the unscathed edge of glass. Stunned, Delta II looked at the center of the dome and realized the bullets had not even come close to penetrating the thick shell. The dome was cratered with pockmarks. An instant later, the topside portal on the sub opened and Michael Tolland emerged. He looked shaky but unscathed. Climbing down the aluminum gangway, Tolland stepped onto the deck and eyed his sub's destroyed dome window.
10,000 pounds per square inch, Tolland said. Looks like you need a bigger gun.
Inside the hydro lab, Rachel knew time was running out. She had heard the gunshots out on the deck and was praying that everything had happened exactly as Tolland had planned. She no longer cared who was behind the meteorite deception. The NASA administrator, Marjorie Tench, or the president himself, none of it mattered anymore. They will not get away with this. Whoever it is, the truth will be told. The wound on Rachel's arm had stopped bleeding, and the adrenaline coursing through her body had muted the pain and sharpened her focus. Finding a pen and paper, she scrawled a 2-line message. The words were blunt and awkward, but eloquence was not a luxury she had time for at the moment. She added the note to the incriminating stack of papers in her hand, the GPR printout. Images of Bithynius giganteus, photos and articles regarding oceanic chondrils, an electron microscan printout. The meteorite was a fake, and this was the proof. Rachel inserted the entire stack into the Hydrolab's fax machine. Knowing only a few fax numbers by heart, she had limited choices, but she had already made up her mind who would be receiving these pages and her note. Holding her breath, she carefully typed in the person's fax number. She pressed send, praying she had chosen the recipient wisely. The fax machine beeped. Error, no dial tone. Rachel had expected this. The Goya's communications were still being jammed. She stood waiting and watching the machine, hoping it functioned like hers at home. Come on! After 5 seconds, the machine beeped again. Redialing. Yes! Rachel watched the machine lock into an endless loop. Error, no dial tone. Redialing. Error, no dial tone. Redialing. Leaving the fax machine in search of a dial tone, Rachel dashed out of the hydro lab just as helicopter blades thundered overhead. Chapter 119. 160 miles away from the Goya, Gabrielle Ashe was staring at Senator Sexton's computer screen in mute astonishment. Her suspicions had been right, but she had never imagined how right. She was looking at digital scans of dozens of bank checks written to Sexton from private space companies and deposited in numbered accounts in the Cayman Islands. The smallest check Gabrielle saw was for $15,000. Several were upward of $500,000. Small potatoes, Sexton had told her. All the donations are under the $2,000 cap. Obviously, Sexton had been lying all along. Gabrielle was looking at illegal campaign financing on an enormous scale. The pangs of betrayal and disillusionment settled hard now in her heart. He lied. She felt stupid. She felt dirty. But most of all,
She felt mad.
Gabrielle sat alone in the darkness, realizing she had no idea what to do next. Chapter 120. Above the Goya, as the Kiowa banked over the stern deck, Delta One gazed down, his eyes fixating on an utterly unexpected vision. Michael Tolland was standing on deck beside a small submersible. Dangling in the sub's robotic arms, as if in the clutches of a giant insect, hung Delta Two, struggling in vain to free himself from two enormous claws.
What in the name of God?
Equally as shocking an image, Rachel Sexton had just arrived on deck, taking up a position over a bound and bleeding man at the foot of the submersible. The man could only be Delta Three. Rachel held one of the Delta Force's machine guns on him and stared up at the chopper as if daring them to attack. Delta One felt momentarily disoriented, unable to fathom how this possibly could have happened. The Delta Force's errors on the ice shelf earlier had been a rare but explainable occurrence. This, however, was unimaginable. Delta One's humiliation would have been excruciating enough under normal circumstances, but tonight his shame was magnified by the presence of another individual riding with him inside the chopper, a person whose presence here was highly unconventional, the Controller. Following the Delta's kill at the FDR Memorial, the Controller had ordered Delta One to fly to a deserted public park not far from the White House. On the Controller's command, Delta One had sat down on a grassy knoll among some trees just as the Controller, having parked nearby, strode out of the darkness and boarded the Kiowa. They were all en route again in a matter of seconds. Although a Controller's direct involvement in mission operations was rare, Delta One could hardly complain. The Controller, distressed by the way the Delta Force had handled the kills on the Milne ice shelf, and fearing increasing suspicions and scrutiny from a number of parties, had informed Delta One that the final phase of the operation would be overseen in person. Now the Controller was riding shotgun, witnessing in person a failure the likes of which Delta One had never endured. This must end. Now. The Controller gazed down from the Kiowa at the deck of the Goya and wondered how this could possibly have happened. Nothing had gone properly. The suspicions about the meteorite, the failed Delta kills on the ice shelf, the necessity of the high-profile kill at the FDR. "Controller," Delta One stammered, his tone one of stunned disgrace as he looked at the situation on the deck of the Goya. "I cannot imagine." "Nor can I," the Controller thought. Their quarry had obviously been grossly underestimated. The Controller looked down at Rachel Sexton, who stared up blankly at the chopper's reflective windshield and raised a cryptalk device to her mouth. When her synthesized voice crackled inside the Kiowa, the Controller expected her to demand that the chopper back off or extinguish the jamming system so Tolan could call for help. But the words Rachel Sexton spoke were far more chilling.
"You're too late," she said. "We're not the only ones who know."
The words echoed for a moment inside the chopper. Although the claim seemed far-fetched, the faintest possibility of truth gave the Controller pause. The success of the entire project required the elimination of all those who knew the truth. And as bloody as the containment had turned out to be, the Controller had to be certain this was the conclusion.
"Someone else knows."
Considering Rachel Sexton's reputation for following strict protocol of classified data, the Controller found it very hard to believe that she would have decided to share this with an outside source. Rachel was on the cryptalk again.
"Back off and we'll spare your men. Come any closer and they die. Either way, the truth comes out. Cut your losses. Back off."
"You're bluffing," the Controller said,
knowing the voice Rachel Sexton was hearing was an androgynous, robotic tone.
"You have told no one."
"Are you ready to take that chance?"
Rachel fired back.
"I couldn't get through to William Pickering earlier, so I got spooked and took out some insurance."
The Controller frowned. It was plausible.
They're not buying it,
Rachel said, glancing at Tolland. The soldier in the claws gave a pained smirk.
Your gun is empty, and the chopper's going to blow you to hell. You're both going to die. Your only hope is to let us go.
Like hell, Rachel thought, trying to assess their next move. She looked at the bound and gagged man who lay at her feet directly in front of the sub. He looked delirious from loss of blood. She crouched beside him, looking into the man's hard eyes.
I'm going to take off your gag and hold the crypt talk. You're going to convince the helicopter to back off. Is that clear?
The man nodded earnestly. Rachel pulled off the man's gag. The soldier spat a wad of bloody saliva up into Rachel's face.
Bitch! He hissed, coughing. I'm going to watch you die. They're going to kill you like a pig, and I'm going to enjoy every minute of it.
Rachel wiped the hot saliva from her face as she felt Tolland's hands lifting her away, pulling her back, steadying her as he took her machine gun. She could feel in his trembling touch that something inside him had just snapped. Tolland walked to a control panel a few yards away, put his hand on a lever, and locked eyes with the man lying on the deck.
Strike two, Tolland said, and on my ship, that's all you get.
With a resolute rage, Tolland yanked down on the lever. A huge trap door in the deck beneath the Triton fell open like the floor of a gallows. The bound soldier gave a short howl of fear and then disappeared, plummeting through the hole. He fell 30 feet to the ocean below. The splash was crimson. The sharks were on him instantly. The controller shook with rage, looking down from the Kiowa at what was left of Delta III's body drifting out from under the boat on the strong current. The illuminated water was pink. Several fish fought over something that looked like an arm.
Jesus Christ!
The controller looked back at the deck. Delta II still hung in the Triton's claws, but now the sub was suspended over a gaping hole in the deck. His feet dangled over the void. All Tolland had to do was release the claws, and Delta II would be next.
Okay, the controller barked into the cryptalk. Hold on! Just hold on!
Rachel stood below on the deck and stared up at the Kiowa. Even from this height, the controller sensed the resolve in her eyes. Rachel raised the cryptalk to her mouth.
You still think we're bluffing? She said. Call the main switchboard at the NRO. Ask for Jim Similjan. He's in P&A on the night shift. I told him everything about the meteorite. He will confirm.
She's giving me a specific name. This did not bode well. Rachel Sexton was no fool, and this was a bluff the controller could check in a matter of seconds. Although the controller knew of no one at the NRO named Jim Similjan, the organization was enormous. Rachel could quite possibly be telling the truth. Before ordering the final kill, the controller had to confirm if this was a bluff or not. Delta One looked over his shoulder.
You want me to deactivate the jammer so you can call and check it out?
The controller peered down at Rachel and Tolland, both in plain view. If either of them made a move for a cell phone or radio, the controller knew Delta One could always reactivate and cut them off. The risk was minimal.
Kill the jammer, the controller said, pulling out a cell phone. I'll confirm Rachel's lying. Then we'll find a way to get Delta Two and end this.
In Fairfax, the operator at the NRO's central switchboard was getting impatient.
As I just told you, I see no Jim Similjan in the plans and analysis division.
The caller was insistent.
Have you tried multiple spellings? Have you tried other departments?
The operator had already checked, but she checked again. After several seconds, she said,
Nowhere on staff do we have a Jim Similjan, under any spelling.
The caller sounded oddly pleased by this.
So you are certain the NRO employs no Jim Simil...
A sudden flurry of activity erupted on the line. Someone yelled. The caller cursed aloud and promptly hung up. On board the Kiowa, Delta One was screaming with rage as he scrambled to reactivate the jamming system. He had made the realization too late. In the huge array of lighted controls in the cockpit, a tiny LED meter indicated that a SATCOM data signal was being transmitted from the Goya. But how? Nobody left the deck. Before Delta One could engage the jammer, the connection from the Goya terminated on its own accord. Inside the hydro lab, the fax machine beeped contentedly. Carrier found. Fax sent. Chapter 121. Kill or be killed. Rachel had discovered a part of herself she never knew existed. Survival mode. A savage fortitude fueled by fear.
What was in that outbound fax? The voice on the cryptalk demanded.
Rachel was relieved to hear the confirmation that the fax had gone out as planned.
Leave the area, she demanded, speaking into the cryptalk and glaring up at the hovering chopper. It's over. Your secret is out.
Rachel informed their attackers of all the information she had just sent. A half dozen pages of images and text, incontrovertible evidence that the meteorite was a fake.
Harming us will only make your situation worse.
There was a heavy pause.
Who did you send the fax to?
Rachel had no intention of answering that question. She and Tallinn needed to buy as much time as possible. They had positioned themselves near the opening in the deck, on a direct line with the Triton, making it impossible for the chopper to shoot without hitting the soldier dangling in the sub's claws.
William Pickering, the voice guessed, sounding oddly hopeful. You faxed Pickering.
Wrong, Rachel thought. Pickering would have been her first choice, but she had been forced to choose someone else for fear her attackers had already eliminated Pickering. A move whose boldness would be a chilling testimony to her enemy's resolve. In a moment of desperate decision, Rachel had faxed the data to the only other fax number she knew by heart. Her father's office. Senator Sexton's office fax number had been painfully engraved into Rachel's memory after her mother's death, when her father chose to work out many of the particulars of the estate without having to deal with Rachel in person. Rachel never imagined she would turn to her father in a time of need, but tonight the man possessed two critical qualities. All the correct political motivations to release the meteorite data without hesitation, and enough clout to call the White House and blackmail them into calling off this kill squad. Although her father was most certainly not in the office at this hour, Rachel knew he kept his office locked like a vault. Rachel had, in effect, faxed the data into a time-lock safe. Even if the attackers knew where she had sent it, chances were slim they could get through the tight federal security at the Philip A. Hart Senate office building and break into a senator's office without anyone noticing.
Wherever you sent the fax, the voice from above said, you put that person in danger.
Rachel knew she had to speak from a position of power, regardless of the fear she was feeling. She motioned to the soldier trapped in the Triton's claws. His legs dangled over the abyss, dripping blood 30 feet to the ocean.
The only person in danger here is your agent, she said into the cryptalk. It's over. Back off. The data is gone. You've lost. Leave the area or this man dies.
The voice on the cryptalk fired back.
Miss Sexton, you do not understand the importance.
Understand? Rachel exploded.
I understand that you killed innocent people. I understand that you lied about the meteorite. I understand that you won't get away with this. Even if you kill us all, it's over.
There was a long pause. Finally, the voice said,
I'm coming down.
Rachel felt her muscles tighten.
Coming down? I am unarmed, the voice said. Do not do anything rash. You and I need to talk face to face.
Before Rachel could react, the chopper dropped onto the Goya's deck. The passenger door on the fuselage opened, and a figure stepped out. He was a plain-looking man in a black coat and tie. For an instant, Rachel's thoughts went totally blank. She was staring at William Pickering. William Pickering stood on the deck of the Goya and gazed with regret at Rachel Sexton. He had never imagined today would come to this. As he moved toward her, he could see the dangerous combination of emotions in his employee's eyes. Shock, betrayal, confusion, rage. All understandable, he thought. There is so much she does not understand. For a moment, Pickering flashed on his daughter, Diana, wondering what emotions she had felt before she died. Both Diana and Rachel were casualties of the same war, a war Pickering had vowed to fight forever. Sometimes the casualties could be so cruel. Rachel, Pickering said, we can still work this out. There's a lot I need to explain. Rachel Sexton looked aghast, nauseated almost. Tolland had the machine gun now and was aiming it at Pickering's chest. He, too, looked bewildered. Stay back, Tolland yelled. Pickering stopped 5 yards away, focusing on Rachel. Your father is taking bribes, Rachel. Payoffs from private space companies. He plans to dismantle NASA and open space to the private sector. He had to be stopped as a matter of national security. Rachel's expression was blank. Pickering sighed. NASA, for all its flaws, must remain a government entity. Certainly she can understand the dangers. Privatization would send NASA's best minds and ideas flooding into the private sector. The brain trust would dissolve. The military would lose access. Private space companies looking to raise capital would start selling NASA patents and ideas to the highest bidders worldwide. Rachel's voice was tremulous. You faked the meteorite and killed innocent people in the name of national security? It was never supposed to happen like this, Pickering said. The plan was to save an important government agency. Killing was not part of it. The meteorite deception, Pickering knew, like most intelligence proposals, had been the product of fear. 3 years ago, in an effort to extend the NRO hydrophones into deeper water where they could not be touched by enemy saboteurs, Pickering spearheaded a program that utilized a newly developed NASA building material to secretly design an astonishingly durable submarine, capable of carrying humans to the deepest regions of the ocean, including the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Forged from a revolutionary ceramic, this two-man submarine was designed from blueprints hacked from the computer of a California engineer named Graham Hawks, a genius sub-designer whose life dream was to build an ultra-deep-water submersible he called Deep Flight 2. Hawks was having trouble finding funding to build a prototype. Pickering, on the other hand, had an unlimited budget. Using the classified ceramic submersible, Pickering sent a covert team underwater to affix new hydrophones to the walls of the Mariana Trench, deeper than any enemy could possibly look. In the process of drilling, however, they uncovered geologic structures unlike any that scientists had ever seen. The discoveries included chondrules and fossils of several unknown species. Of course, because the NRO's ability to dive this deep was classified, none of the information could ever be shared. It was not until recently, driven yet again by fear, that Pickering and his quiet team of NRO science advisors had decided to put their knowledge of the Marianas' unique geology to work to help save NASA. Turning a Mariana rock into a meteorite had proven to be a deceptively simple task. Using an ECE slush hydrogen engine, the NRO team charred the rock with a convincing fusion crust. Then, using a small payload sub, They had descended beneath the Milne ice shelf and inserted the charred rock up into the ice from beneath. Once the insertion shaft refroze, the rock looked like it had been there for over 300 years. Unfortunately, as was often the case in the world of covert operations, the grandest of plans